It might seem that Gustav Rakatos would have found Aeva's public criticisms useful. The two were, after all, saying much the same thing, and certainly they were pursuing the same objective. But Avrakatos had many reasons for fearing the public attacks once Gordon Humphrey got into the mix. For one thing, the civilian Pentagon officials involved in security affairs were starting to maneuver to take over the Afghan operation, claiming that the CIA did not know how to run a military campaign. Furthermore, Humphrey and Aeva were enlisting other conservative senators, and the idea of Congress gearing up for a sustained public attack threatened to erode confidence in the program, just when Gust and Charlie had finally managed to get the resources the agency needed to show what could be done. Here, Wilson orchestrated another cunningly effective campaign to soften these challenges to Avrakatos' Afghan program. Early on, he decided that most of the activists involved in lobbying for the Afghans were highly peculiar and excessive in their criticism, not only of the CIA and the U.S. government, but of the other groups that were involved in the same cause. Indeed, he would soon come to view them as very much like their Afghan clients, ostensibly sharing the same broad cause, but caught up in internecine warfare. Many were even more extreme in their zealousness than Aeva and Free the Eagle. There was the Washington-based Committee for a Free Afghanistan, originally led by an intimidating former Army officer, Karen McKay, who had once undergone limited jump school training and would sometimes appear at conservative gatherings in uniform, wearing a green beret. Two other equally formidable women worked out of a respected New York foundation, Freedom House, Roseanne Class and Ludmilla Thorne. Wilson's political antenna told him right away that it would be highly dangerous to cross any of these zealots. For one thing, they all seemed to hate each other. The Committee for a Free Afghanistan, for example, refused to let Aeva into any of its meetings, and Aeva reciprocated by accusing the committee of being a CIA front. Wilson made it a point to see them all whenever they called, to offer encouragement, but diplomatically avoid signing on publicly with any of them. He played his role masterfully here. By now, he was for all practical purposes a critical player in the very center of the CIA's Afghan operation, though he managed to make the entire range of ardent critics believe he was with them in their bitter attacks on the agency. In the councils of his Appropriations Subcommittee and in conferences with the Senate, however, he had already assumed the role of Langley's advocate, able to make the case for the way the Afghan operation was being run. It may be that Wilson was better informed at that time than anyone in the agency, except a few members of Avrakatos's inner circle. He could tell his colleagues that he had been to Cairo, had seen the weapons being bought, had been to Pakistan and the Mujahideen camps, and could state from first-hand experience how effective the program was becoming. He was already playing the part that the CIA's number two man, John McMahon, would later call that of the agency's case officer on the Hill. There was an element of duplicity in Wilson's dealings here. In truth, it suited him just fine to have these crazies moving menacingly around the fringes, hurling virtual bombs and attacking bureaucrats. For example, Charlie would always defend John McMahon in public, but he recognized that the deputy director was in fact a conservative force at the agency, and that other CIA officials were even more dubious about escalating. It didn't hurt to have the bureaucrats feel the pressure. On occasion, when he sensed resistance at state or the agency, he would deliberately stir Aeva up. Perhaps Wilson's most masterful maneuver on behalf of the CIA effort came in his dealings with Senator Humphrey. Here, Charlie chose to have his role inside the agency remain invisible and to allow Humphrey to assume the public spotlight as the Afghans' key congressional champion. Humphrey was so extreme when it came to Afghanistan that he would camp outside a fellow senator's office if necessary to corner him for a commitment on a vote. He didn't sit on appropriations or intelligence. He couldn't initiate funding increases the way Wilson could. But as an enforcer of senatorial discipline on behalf of the Mujahideen, he managed to make his fellow senators feel that they would have a political enemy for life if they stood in his way, and few cared enough about the issue to choose to alienate such a man. All of this made it possible for Wilson to play the role of the good cop, able to assure the agency capos that he would always cover for them. At the same time, he made it clear that they should recognize that within the range of strident criticisms were some points that ought not to be ignored. Meanwhile, Avrakatos had to deal with the fact that Gordon Humphrey, with all of his conservative credentials, was preparing to try the agency in public. As he saw it, The CIA's credibility and right to continue its escalating operation was in jeopardy. Early in 1985, Gust decided it was time to co-opt the senator. Mike Vickers was put in charge of organizing a dog and pony show at the agency's Camp Perry training ground. Humphrey tried to bring Ava, but Avrakatos pointed out that Humphrey, who did not sit on the Intelligence Committee, wasn't even cleared for what he was going to be shown. Bert Dunn, the Near East Division Chief, came along, and he and Gust sat back as Vickers did the briefing. Gust had samples of most of the weapons the Mujahideen were using flown in from all over the country. The contrast between Humphrey's public accusation about the CIA's failure to adequately arm the Mujahideen and the range of sophisticated weaponry from the arsenal displayed before his eyes was so stark that no one mentioned it directly. As Humphrey was shown the impressive arsenal that he had claimed did not exist, three battle-hardened agency paramilitaries told of their experiences training the Mujahideen and then helped the senator fire the weapons. This carefully choreographed performance was designed to persuade Humphrey that the agency was not wimpish, and after exploding a particularly lethal mine for the senator, Gust said with studied forethought, "You think we're putting chicken shit mines in? Did you see this fucking round? It went through the son of a bitch better than Joe Lewis penetrating a white woman." He didn't like that comment, Gust remarked years later, but that was the reason why Avrakatos had chosen such an ugly and crude analogy. He was out to intimidate Humphrey into silence. At one point, the senator asked if Avrakatos could account for all the money and weapons being given to the Pakistanis and the Afghans. "We can't. Can you account for all the money going into New Hampshire from the federal government?" Avrakatos asked in return. "We use satellites as best we can. We put beacons on some packages and various crates, and overhead we study what happens to the shipments, and we do a pretty good job of it." The entire Camp Perry exercise had one simple objective, intimidation, and Avrakatos saved his most effective ploy for the end when he explained in front of his fellow operatives that the agency wasn't able to refute the senator's charges publicly because it didn't want the Soviets to know what the Mujahideen were getting. "You're undermining what we're trying to do. You're a fifth column. Now that you've seen everything we're giving to the Muj, you certainly should know that Andreyeva is incorrect, and I assume you are satisfied." Unlike Wilson, Humphrey never did become a partner of the CIA, and no one connected to the Afghan program seems to have anything but unflattering things to say about him. But Avrakatos maintains that by the end of that day at Camp Perry, Gordon Humphrey had been largely neutralized. For Avrakatos, 1985 was a year of right-wing craziness. About the same time Humphrey surfaced as a menace, he was confronted with a far weirder and more threatening problem from inside the government. A band of well-placed anti-communist enthusiasts in the administration had come up with a plan they believed would bring down the Red Army, if the CIA would only be willing to implement it. The leading advocates of this plan included Richard Perle at the Pentagon, so intense in his Cold War convictions that he was nicknamed the Prince of Darkness. Oliver North also checked in briefly, but the man who set Avrakatos's teeth on edge most was Walt Raymond, another NSC staffer who had spent 20 years with the CIA as a propagandist. Their idea was to encourage Soviet officers and soldiers to defect to the Mujahideen. As Avrakatos derisively describes it, "The Muj were supposed to set up loudspeakers in the mountains announcing such things as, 'Lay down your arms, there's a passage to the West and to freedom.'" Once news of this program made its way through the Red Army, it was argued, there would be a flood of defectors. This vision was based on Vlasov's army, a German-backed effort during World War II to persuade communist soldiers to join an anti-Stalinist front. It had met with some success before collapsing, enough at least to excite the passionate efforts of its latter-day advocates. Andreyeva, not surprisingly, was deeply involved in this effort. He had gone to Pakistan in the early 1980s trying to find Russian prisoners to demonstrate how effective such a policy could be, but he had learned that the Mujahideen did not have much interest in keeping prisoners alive. At a White House meeting, North and Perle told Avrakatos they wanted the agency to spend millions on this program, expressing the belief that as many as 10,000 defectors could be expected to pour across the lines. Avrakatos thought North and Perle were cuckoos of the far right, and he soon felt quite certain that Raymond, the man who seemed to be the intellectual ringleader was truly detached from reality. "What Russian in his right mind would defect to those fuckers all armed to the teeth?" Avrakatos said in frustration. "To begin with, anyone defecting to the Dushman would have to be a crook, a thief, or someone who wanted to get cornholed every day, because 9 out of 10 prisoners were dead within 24 hours, and they were always turned into concubines by the Mujahideen. I felt so sorry for them, I wanted to have them all shot."